Welcome to Built to Go, a van life podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wagg, coming to you from the College of Curiosity. This time it's episode 225, and we're going to talk about 10 things people forget when they're building out or at least planning their van. What are those things that when you're all done, you go, oh no, I forgot. Well, we're also going to talk about some interesting news involving a new Ford van that we know nothing at all about. Some tech talk involving how to go downhill, which is more important than you might think. And a tale from the road involving dowsing, which is a whole other interesting topic. Hello, folks. Welcome back. Thank you for joining me here once again. Let's dive right in. You know, this has happened to me, and I'm sure it's happened to a lot of you, is that you're done with your van. You're finally, you have proclaimed it done. Because as we know, you're never done. You're never, ever going to be done with your van. But at some point, you're going to say, I'm done! And then you're going to find out you forgot something very important. So I put together a list of 10 things that people commonly forget. There are many, many more than 10. This is just a list of 10, some of which I forgot myself. And some of which I remembered at the last minute and then made amends for. So one of the first things is, where's your trash going to go? Now, obviously, you are going to make trash if you live in your van. And where is it going to go? And so you might think, oh, well, I'll just put in a trash can or I'll hang a bag on a hook or whatever. Doesn't matter. Make sure you have a plan for where your trash is going to go. But that's not the end of the story. Because where is that trash going to go? For example, let's say you're going to make a chicken cacciatore some night because you're feeling all fancy, and you've got all this messy chicken stuff, and you know that's it, you don't want that around. So you put it in your trash bag, and you tie it up, however you handle that. Where does that go? Because if you're on an extended trip on BLM land for, say, a week, you've got to store your trash, not only your trash bag that you're currently using, but all the trash bags you filled up before. Where are they going to go? And I'll tell you, outside the van is not an answer because that's where the critters are and the critters can get to them. So figure out where you're going to put them. In my case, what I do, and I'm usually traveling alone, is I will store tightly and neatly wrapped up bags of trash on the passenger floor in front of the passenger seat. That's where I put them. If anything leaks, it's not that big of a deal because it's vinyl. And then they're there, so I see them and I'm aware of them. And anytime I take the van out, I know to stop at a trash can and toss one in every now and then. And that's how I deal with trash. I use small trash bags so that every time I get gas or go to a grocery store or whatever, it's not a big deal to just toss a bag in there. So, yeah, don't forget that one. Number two, similar vein, and I definitely forgot this one, dirty laundry. Where does it go? I mean, you've built out these nice cabinets. Like, I'm going to keep my sweaters in here, and my socks and undies are in here. Where do your dirty socks and undies go? You need to have a place to put dirty laundry. And it's a tough one because you don't want your dirty laundry to mix with your clean laundry. And sometimes you need to, you know, air it out. Maybe your dirty laundry is super dirty because maybe you're doing some real deep woods camping or you're a dirt bag and you're climbing rocks all day and getting all hot and sweaty, whatever the case may be. So my solution for this is a little weird. I've got one of those IKEA cubes that you find at IKEA. They fit in all the different bookcases they sell, and I happen to have one of those bookcases as my bed support in my van. And in there, I have packing cubes. And what I do is I keep my clean clothes in the packing cubes, and my dirty clothes basically are under the packing cubes. So when I start out the trip, I can fill the cube with packing cubes because the amount of clothes you have takes up the same amount of space, whether they're dirty or clean. So I don't have to worry about taking up any other compartments. I just have to worry about where I put my clothes in that compartment based on whether they're dirty or clean. So I will pull out the cube, take out my clean clothes, wear them, and then when they're dirty, I put them at the bottom of the cube and then put the packing cubes back on top. I realize I'm using the word cube for two different things, but such is life. You get the idea. I'm basically putting the dirty laundry on the bottom and clean laundry on the top that's in a separate container. And that works really well. And then when I go to the laundromat, I can just use the IKEA cube and just take that as my laundry basket. Doesn't take up any more space than it has to. But my first build, I completely forgot that I was going to have dirty laundry, and it was kind of a pain. I really didn't know where I was going to put it, and I ended up putting it in like plastic shopping bags and hiding it behind the bed, and anyway, it was messy. So don't forget that one. Number three, another thing people don't think about necessarily is weight. This is especially true for folks with smaller vans. You know, these things have a limited capacity. You can't just keep putting more and more stuff in here. And you might think, oh, I want to take showers, so I'm going to put in the 50-gallon water tank. And yeah, you know, I think I want the extended range of the bigger diesel tank and maybe two spare tires. You know, you start adding this stuff up and you can seriously overload your vehicle, which is going to compress your springs, lower your ground clearance, put more wear and tear on the vehicle in general, and be basically unsafe. Also, there's a reason we don't put our batteries on the roof, because we want the weight to be as close to the bottom of the vehicle as possible. So in a list like this, I can't get into all the ins and outs of how to manage weight, but don't ignore it. Weight matters. And a lot of our rigs that we're building out are completely overloaded, and it's not a good thing. Number four, this one can be painful. Maintenance access. So if you've got your typical cargo van and you're back there and you're like, well, let's just put up some paneling, you know, we'll do some insulation, we'll put up some nice paneling or maybe some pallet wood or whatever. And then your taillight goes out. You're like, okay, I'll just replace the... And then you realize your vehicle, the way you access the taillight is from the inside of the van, and you have to be able to reach back in there in order to change the bulb, and you've covered it up with wood that is now attached to your van with riv nuts or something. Yeah, that's bad. So make sure you understand how to do things like change your taillights, and don't cover that with anything that can't be removed easily. You know, it's not a big deal to remove a few screws and take apart a panel and get in there. But if you're doing glue or you're doing some kind of insulation like spray foam, if you spray foam the entire inside of your van without figuring out where you're going to access certain things, that can be bad. Case in point with this one, NV200s have a fuel pump access port right in the middle of the floor, basically. And if you cover that up, you're giving up access to your fuel pump. And then the only way to access it is to drop the entire fuel tank. It's a lot more complicated process. In my case, I just decided I was willing to make that trade. But make sure you understand where everything is before you start covering stuff. And number five, on that same vein, there is something in your van that you might not be aware of, and that is called a slam vent. Near the back of your van, it doesn't matter which van you have, this is true for all vans and all vehicles, near the floor in the back of the van, there are these grills or holes or some kind of plastic molding that looks like a vent. You can't see light through it, you can't really see what it does. What's there is a rubber flap, and the idea is that if you slam the door, the air pressure that is caused from you slamming the door and compressing the air in the vehicle will be released through these vents. And they typically will vent under the vehicle right there, or sometimes into the taillight assembly. That depends on the van. If you cover these up, you're going to find it very, very difficult to close your doors. So if you've done your van build and suddenly, man, it is just really hard to shut the doors. It's like they shut, but they only click once. They won't ever click all the way, and then I have to push on them again. I'll bet you have your slam vents covered. These things do serve a purpose. So find them. Go in your vehicle, find the slam vents, and then don't cover them with anything that won't let air through. You can just leave space so air can get through there. That's fine. If you want to put in spacers and cover them with a piece of wood, but you have 2-inch spacers or something like that, that works fine. But don't cover them completely, because it will literally be hard to shut your doors. Now, if it's too late, if you've already done this, one trick is you roll down a window, shut the doors, and roll the window back up. Not terribly convenient, but it is a solution. Or you put in another vent. You can do that too. Number six, make sure you have a way to get on the roof. This is true, especially if you have solar panels, because they need to be cleaned, but also for maintenance. Like, you may have a problem where you put a vent on your roof in a place where you had nice ladders or scaffolding or whatever, and then you're out in the woods and your vent breaks, but you don't have a ladder with you. How are you going to get up there on the roof to at least cover that vent with a tarp or something so it doesn't rain in your vehicle? So figure out how you're going to get on your roof while you're on the road if you need to. There's a few simple solutions. You can add on a ladder like I did. I got a ladder off Amazon and bolted it to the back door, and I can hop up and down very easily. Or you can bring a ladder with you that's loose. You know, they have those telescoping ladders. You can use those. I think they're scary, but other people report that they work just fine. If you're a rock climber, you can put rock climbing handholds on the outside of your van. I've seen a few people do that. I think that's very clever. Or you can just put these little folding foot grabber things anywhere. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There's lots of ways to do it. Just make sure you have a way to get up on your roof because you might need it when you least expect it. Number 7. We're modifying a lot of stuff in these vans, especially electrical. If you're putting in battery-to-battery chargers or a VSR or anything like that, make sure you leave enough documentation or things are obvious enough that if someone's working on your van who doesn't know your build, they can figure out what's going on. I drive an ambulance, and I can tell you that every single time I take it in for service, they open the hood, and they're like, oh, God, what is all this crap? Because under the hood of my ambulance is all kinds of extra wiring and piping for the rear heat and stuff, and they frankly don't like working on it. Now, I have started labeling stuff so they know what it is. Like, I have extra coolant hoses. You know, I put rear heat on those, and I have a wire running directly from the battery to a fuse to the trailer wiring, because on my Sprinter van, the trailer wiring needs to have power added to it. So that's what that wire is, just coming off the battery under the hood, which weirdly is not the battery that starts the engine. That's a Sprinter thing. Anyway, it doesn't matter. So keep in mind that someone may have to work on your vehicle at some point, and they may not know what the heck is going on. So make sure you have something you can hand them or a way to explain to them what is going on so they can work on your rig. Number 8, ground clearance. I had an incident with this with my Scamp. Yeah, so if you're going to put anything underneath your van, consider what it's going to hit. Everything under the van is subject to be hitting by rocks and whatever, but if you bottom out and hit something under there that you have added, it's going to get ripped off. That's what happened in my Scamp when I put on a homemade black tank. It hung down too low and got ripped off, and that was dumb. So don't do that. Be careful of where you put things underneath. Consider what's going to happen when you go over bumps or up driveways, or, you know, sometimes, especially out west, the road is shaped such that storm water runs in kind of a channel in front of the driveways to businesses, and that can make this dip that makes it real easy to hit your back bumper on the ground. Now consider if you can hit your back bumper on the ground, anything you've mounted under there is going to get hit as well. So just think about that. Whenever you're mounting anything under the vehicle, make sure it is entirely above anything else that could possibly hit, as much as possible. It's not always possible. In my ambulance, for example, my rear air conditioner hangs down lower than anything else. So I know that if I hit something, yeah, that's what's going to get hit. Number 9, very important one. Consider chafing. I'm not talking about personal chafing. That's a separate issue. I'm talking about chafing of wires and things like that. While you're out there on the road, your vehicle is constantly vibrating. And while you might think this smooth piece is rubbing against this smooth piece, what's the big deal? Well, eventually, those two smooth pieces are going to eat into each other. And this is especially a problem with wiring. Make sure that any time your wires wrap around something or hit something, that they're protected against chafing. I cannot tell you how unintuitive this is. You can look and see this wire's really strong, and yeah, it's going around this metal bracket, but that's not going to be a problem. It is going to be a problem. And if it's behind a wall, you might end up with a situation where you're blowing fuses and you don't know why. And you're going to take everything apart to get at these wires that have, over the course of 50,000 miles, worn out and are now making contact with that metal part. So consider chafing. Use wire loom. Use electrical tape. Whatever you're going to do, make sure that every time you are running wires, you think about how chafing is going to affect them. And number 10, and this is a tip that I've been using a lot, and it's one that doesn't really involve your build, but that is when you park your rig, if you have a choice, face north. Why? Because if you're facing north, that means the sun is going to come up in the east, as it always does, and it's going to warm up the passenger side of your rig in the morning, which is typically where people hang out. And then in the evening, the sun is going to go over your van and be on completely the other side of the van, meaning your passenger side is going to be completely shaded and all the heat is going to be beating down on the driver's side. And if you're smart, you put extra insulation over there. This also means that if you're using a three-way fridge, you should try to have it on the passenger side, which is actually fairly rare, but not unheard of. So, park north. If you drive like the British do, park south. So that's 10 things some people forget when they build out. There are many more. And if you can think of one that I should talk about, please send me a note at jeff@builttogo.com. That's two T's, not three, not one. And while I'm on the topic, I would like to say a special thank you to Kent and John D. Hiker for helping to support this show and keeping ads off of the podcast, which is a wonderful thing. They visited buymeacoffee.com/builttogo, bought me a gallon of diesel. That little bit of money that comes in keeps the podcast going without ads. It keeps me happy, it keeps you happy, and allows us to just continue on without having to hear about products that we have no interest in. So thank you guys, and thank you again to all the monthly contributors. Van Life News. Okay, hey, something on the horizon that looks fairly exciting. There's a new Ford van coming, and this is the first I've heard of it. And let me tell you about it. Oh, I can't, because they haven't actually announced a darn thing about it. All they've announced is that the EV market is soft. People are not buying EVs the way they thought they would, so they're going to dial back their efforts to produce EV trucks and EV vans, which I have mixed feelings about. But they are going to put an effort into a new EV van in 2026, and all it says is it's unspecified. We don't know what it is. Is it a new smaller van? Is it an updated Transit? Not a clue. But heck, this is the first time in a long time I've been able to say, there's a new van coming for the American market. So let's hope it's something that we can turn into campers very easily. Link in the show notes, as always. Another interesting thing is they are making a van life movie. They being a group of indigenous folks in Canada who are making an independent movie. This movie is called #VanLife, and it is the first indigenous and Canadian indie to shoot entirely in virtual studio, which seems a little odd. You know, van life is about being outdoors. They're going to shoot this thing entirely virtually, and it looks like it's going to be a horror movie. It's about a couple who's done van life for a couple of years, and they're starting to have some relationship problems, and then they meet some unusual folks, and drama. That's all I can tell you. At any rate, I will definitely watch it and give you guys a review when it's available, but it looks like it's going to take a while. But it's exciting. You know, I always like van life movies because I like van life, and, you know, that makes sense. And last, this is a strange one. You know, in the U.S., we have BLM land, which stands for Bureau of Land Management. Sometimes those initials confuse people, especially in the East, but we're talking about Bureau of Land Management here. And in Western states, some states, like nearly the entire state, is BLM land, which means it's owned by the federal government. This is true of Nevada. If you look at a map of BLM land in Nevada, you're like, it's the whole state except Las Vegas. It's a little, not exactly that, but it's close. And if you look at Utah, it's very similar. You've got basically Salt Lake City and St. George, and then the whole rest of the state's owned by the federal government. Well, apparently Utah's not very happy about that. And they filed suit basically saying, hey, Fed, give us our land. We don't want you to manage it anymore. And their argument is basically that the federal government is holding all this land and they're not doing anything with it. Now, we're not talking about the national park land here. We're talking about just land. And this is very important for van life folks because this land is open to all. It's very similar to Crown land in Canada. We get to camp there for 2 weeks at a time with very few restrictions. You basically just drive out, find a place to park, and don't be a jerk. And you can stay there for 2 weeks. Well, Utah wants to take that away. Now, I don't know what they're going to do with it. I haven't seen any plans for what Utah is going to do with the land. But it will probably be not used in the same way. And that could be bad for us for van life. So we'll see how that goes. The scary part about this is if Utah is successful, well, then Nevada is going to do the same thing. And California might do the same thing in Arizona and New Mexico. And we may find ourselves with a whole lot less land to camp on. So watch this space. We shall see what happens. Links to all those stories in the show notes. Tech Talk. Let's talk about going downhill. So I was in Oregon this past weekend, and I went up to Timberline Lodge, one of my favorite places. And I was on Mount Hood, not at the top of Mount Hood, but halfway up, about 6,000 feet. And in order to get up there, you have to drive up the mountain, which is not too surprising. And in order to come back down, you have to go down the mountain. And I was having a conversation with my wife because we were driving a rental car. It was a hybrid Camry, and it had a fairly complicated shifting system, which a lot of cars have now. But she saw me fiddling with the shifter as we were driving, and she said, "Why are you doing that? Why don't you just step on the brakes?" And I thought, well, you know, she's been driving for probably 30 years. How is it that she doesn't know about this? And I realized that she spent her entire life in Illinois. She grew up in a place where it's completely flat, and she's really never had to learn all the skills about going downhill. So we had a quick conversation about it. So basically, if you're going to go downhill in your vehicle, you do not normally want to step on the brakes the whole way because your brakes will heat up. When your brakes heat up enough, they can cause the hydraulic fluid to become a gas instead of a liquid. And liquid is semi-compressible, gas is completely compressible, which means basically your brakes will shut off. If you hold your brakes long enough going down a hill, you will have no brakes. That's a very basic, simple thing that every first-time driver should know. But it's a little more complicated than that. One way to stop that is to use engine braking. Now, I'm not talking about Jake brakes or those things that trucks use that goes... That's a different system, although it works on the same principle. I'm just talking about the normal engine braking you have in your vehicle, which is that if you downshift, even in an automatic, the wheels connected to the engine will make the engine work harder. That will make your car slow down. Basically, the engine's going to limit itself to a certain number of RPMs, and that will keep your vehicle at a steady speed. So, in general, going downhill, you're not going to step on the brakes. You're just going to downshift and let the vehicle handle itself. It takes a little bit of practice, but it's not too hard. Now, it's a little bit more complicated now because some cars, like this Camry, have regenerative braking, which means that if you step on the brakes, it doesn't necessarily apply the brakes. It may automatically do engine braking without you changing gears in order to recharge the battery. And it dawned on me that I don't actually know what you're supposed to do in a hybrid if you're going downhill. Now, there is a lot of controversy over this. I tried to find the definitive answer. The best answer I found, and I like this answer, is if you're in a hybrid, like there are hybrid minivans out there now, you should just use cruise control to go down the hill. Set the speed that you want to go down the hill at and let the vehicle figure it out. There is an argument that you should not downshift, that you should use the brakes because that will maximize regeneration. I get that. But at some point, the battery is going to be full and you're going to be using your brakes. And then what if they overheat? And I don't know how the vehicle handles that. Yes, you can downshift, but in hybrids, downshifting isn't as useful because the engines are smaller. Hybrid cars have smaller engines because they've got a big battery to help them out. So it's a little bit strange. At any rate, read your owner's manual for your vehicle if you have a hybrid. If you don't have a hybrid, absolutely use engine braking. And I know on modern vehicles, it's not as simply as just shifting down. You've probably got push buttons on your steering wheel, like I have in my Ram truck. It's a little strange. One last thing about going downhill, and this is something that I have learned recently, and it was something I was doing wrong. When I was coming back from Vermont in my Sprinter, which has an automatic transmission, I encountered a bunch of long hills. I mean, that's how it is in the Adirondacks. So I'm going down one of these long hills. It's like 2 miles long. It's completely straight. And I'm like, yeah, why not throw it in neutral? So I put the transmission in neutral, and I'm just rolling down the hill exactly at the speed I want, don't need any brakes, using very little fuel, all is right with the world. And then the hill starts to get flat, and I need to add a little bit more accelerator, so I shift into drive, and the shift indicator on the dashboard, the D, starts blinking. And I step on the fuel, and it just revs. Basically, the transmission has disengaged from the vehicle. It's telling me, you're screwed. You're not going anywhere. Uh-oh. Again, don't want to break down in the Adirondack. So I coasted to the shoulder very safely, put the vehicle in park, put it back in drive, and everything was fine. So what happened? Well, when I learned how to drive, I learned on an automatic, but I quickly switched to manual, and I drove a manual most of the time, and I had learned from a young age to go ahead and put it in neutral going downhill. Yes, there's some safety things. Obviously, you can't react quickly. If you needed to speed up going down a hill for whatever reason, you'd have to shift in gear first. I get that. But taking that into consideration, you might as well save the fuel by putting in neutral. What I didn't do is take into consideration how automatic transmissions work. And the problem is that if you put it in neutral going down the hill, the transmission may not be getting lubricated properly, and you can cause it to overheat and malfunction. You can even destroy your transmission, depending on your vehicle, by coasting in neutral down hills. And what had happened in my Mercedes is that putting it in neutral while I was driving down the hill had generated an error message, and as a safety thing, it shut off the transmission. So, if you have an automatic transmission vehicle, which nearly all of you do if you're in the United States, don't coast down hills in neutral. It's not good for the transmission. If you've got a manual transmission, I don't think you've got a problem. But for automatics, modern automatics are strange. They vary a lot from vehicle to vehicle. They're very complex. Don't risk it. If you're going down a hill, go ahead and step on the accelerator till you're at the speed you'd like to be at. So, yeah, a lot more complicated going downhill than you thought, huh? You were just like, hey, gravity's going to do all the work. You're going to have to keep that gravity under control, or you're going to be in big trouble. Product review. So I spend my weekends in either the van or the Scamp or the Airstream. I'm almost half of every week I'm on the road in some way or other. And, you know, I like to watch TV like a lot of people. But there's the problem that if you stream when you're on the road, you're eating up minutes. It can be difficult. So I have an iPad that has a cellular plan on it. Basically, all our phones and the iPad are on the same plan. We pay $25 a month for the iPad to be connected to the world just like a phone. What does this have to do with watching movies? Well, I typically will just use the iPad for watching everything, but the Airstream we have has a big TV in it, and so why not watch things on the TV? Well, it turns out that you can connect the iPad to the TV via HDMI, and then anything that's on the iPad you can watch on the screen. What this translates to is you can stream unlimited onto a big TV if you have an iPad with a cell phone plan. The trick is you need the right cable. So if you have a modern iPad, and it's going to have to be a newer one, it has a USB-C connection, you can buy a cable that will turn that USB-C into HDMI. And I've tried a few of them. I've tried adapters, I've tried little boxes that have all kinds of things. They were all giving me trouble until I bought the thing I'm recommending here today. And it's just a cable. It has HDMI on one end, USB-C on the other. That's it. Plug it into your iPad, plug it into your fairly modern television that has HDMI, and boom, the iPad figures out that the monitor is another screen, and you can watch YouTube and Netflix and all that stuff using your unlimited data plan, which is what I've got on mine. It won't eat up any minutes because AT&T considers it to be just another phone. If I were to use my laptop with a hotspot setting, it would count against me for minutes because I don't know of any company that does free hotspot. I could be wrong about that. Anyway, if you own an iPad and your iPad has a cellular connection, you absolutely can hook it up to a TV very simply with just this cable that I have linked in the show notes. The one I have in the show notes is just an example of it. It doesn't matter. I would recommend you do not buy a cheap one. HDMI is a fairly finicky protocol. You may run into digital rights management problems with the cheaper ones, but this is a great way for folks to gather around a big TV and stream video without having to pay anything extra. So, link in the show notes. I love it. I use it every weekend, and it's just another way to stay inside your van and have fun. Tales from the road. So way back in the day, wasn't that, was it that long ago? Jeez, this story is probably 15 years old now. Maybe time, this time thing doesn't stop. Anyway, I was at Dragon Con. Dragon Con is a massive convention of conventions, basically, that's held in Atlanta every Labor Day weekend. Massive affair, 80,000 people or so, all kinds of famous people, all your favorite sci-fi show stars, and there's D&D stuff, there's costumes, there's all kinds of stuff going on there. And I haven't been for many years now, but I used to go every year, I used to give talks. And one year, representing the James Randi Educational Foundation, we did a test for the $1 Million Challenge. Briefly, our organization, the James Randi Educational Foundation, founded by James the Amazing Randi, would give you $1 million if you could demonstrate, under scientific conditions, any paranormal, supernatural, or occult ability. If you could see through walls, or you could talk to spirits, or whatever your claim was, we would test it under scientific protocols. And if you passed, we would give you $1 million. Now, I was the guy managing this, and I can tell you the money was real. We absolutely would have paid the $1 million. The trick was, there wasn't a trick. We just have no evidence that this stuff is real. And should we find some evidence that this stuff was real, that would more than make up for the $1 million that would have cost us. So, one of the most commonly tested things we did was dowsing. You can douse for many things, but the most common thing people do for dowsing is for water. And the classic example is you take a forked stick, hold one end of the fork in each hand, and then walk along until you feel the fork twitch, and that means there's water underneath. Basic and simple. It's easy to do this, and it's easy to convince yourself that it works. Here's how. Grab yourself a forked stick, or what I like to use is two pieces of bent wire, say from a coat hanger, and hold them straight in front of you, and hold them very, very loosely so that they can swing very easily. And then test this for yourself. Put a bowl of water on the ground, and then as you go towards the bowl of water, you'll see the wires cross right over the water. And that's how it works. You can put an empty bowl in a full bowl and try it, and you will see, and this works, I'm not kidding here, the wires will cross over the water and won't cross over the empty. So, I mean, that shows dowsing works, right? Well, as you might have expected, it's a little bit more complicated than that. When someone came to us and said that they could douse for water, or sometimes they could douse for gold, I mean, they could say whatever they wanted, they were absolutely convinced it was a real skill, because they would do what we just discussed here, and we would say, okay, let's do that test, but here's how we're going to do it. We're going to get 10 paint cans. 9 of them are going to be filled with sand. 1 of them is going to be filled with water. And if you can detect that can that's filled with water 10 times in a row, we will be convinced that you have the ability. So, what's the difference, right? So, what we would do is make sure that their skills worked. We would pull out the can with the water and say, here's the can with the water, try it. And they would go over and the wires would cross and boom, that proved that it worked. The can wasn't shielding the water or anything like that. Then we'd take that can and mix it up with all the other cans of sand so they were roughly the same weight. We'd be careful that you couldn't see condensation or anything like that. We had magicians examine the protocol to make sure there wasn't anything sneaky like that. And then on the big stage at Dragon Con, we had this all lined up and we waited for the claimant to come and show us his amazing abilities. And he didn't come. The guy didn't show up, which was a little disappointing because we had 1,000 people in the audience ready to watch this. So, instead, what we did was, well, folks, you're all here to see, let's just do this for fun. And so we picked some guy randomly out of the audience and said, hey, can you douse? And he said he didn't even know what dowsing was. Okay, that's fine. So he showed him the basics. And again, this will work. If you try this, if you take 2 pieces of bent coat hanger wire, hold them loosely in your hands, and bring them over water, they will cross. I'll explain why in a moment. So we showed him that, and he was convinced that he now knew how to douse. That was it. And we did the test with him, and the first time he went out there, he put the wires over the 10 cans, and they crossed over one. And he said, I guess that's where the water is. And so we pulled out the can and opened it up, and he was right. Yeah, that's where the water was. So, he beat 10 to 1 odds there, or 9 to 1 odds. Okay, so we closed the can back up, pulled the curtain, reordered everything, opened the curtain again, and had him try again. Same thing. Dun, 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 dun. Oh, on the third one, the wires cross. I think it's this one. We pull out the can, and he's right again. And at this point, we're a little baffled because we have done many, 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 many of these tests, and at this point, he has beaten everybody so far. The odds, 10 to 1. If you do 10 to 1 twice, that's 100 to 1. He has just beaten 100 to 1 odds, which is pretty good. But he's still going to do it 8 more times. And so we do the test 8 more times. And he fails. Every single time. And by the end, he's confused. He's like, it worked twice. Why did it stop working? Did something wear off? Did something change? Did you guys cheat? We didn't cheat. Here's what was going on. And why this was extraordinary. First off, dowsing is not real. You can't douse for water. I'll bet there are people listening to this podcast right now who are absolutely convinced I'm wrong, and they would love to have tried for this $1 million. The belief in dowsing is so pervasive and so strong that when it's explained, it's not satisfying. But I'm going to explain how it works right now. Dowsing works on something called the ideomotor response. Ideo meaning idea, motor meaning movement. And what's happening is that you're holding these wires very loosely. It doesn't take much of them to move. And if you bring them over the water, you expect them to cross. And you're actually moving your muscles such that the wires will cross. But you don't know it. The idea that they're going to cross is enough for you to subtly move the wires and have them cross, but you're completely unaware that you moved anything. So the sensation is that it absolutely worked. And this is why it doesn't work when containers are closed, because you can't see the water. We have tested dozens of people on this. None of them have beaten chance. Well, that's what was so amazing about this thing at Dragon Con. This random guy we picked out of the audience actually did slightly better than Chance. Chance says he should have gotten one of those cans in 10 runs at this whole experiment, but he got two. That's better than anyone else has ever done. And it is proof of nothing. That's how chance works. Somebody is going to be above average. Someone's going to be below average. That's what averages are. They're the aggregate of what everyone's done. And so, on average, you're going to get one. But there's plenty of people who got zero, and there's a few people who get two, or maybe even more. And yes, if you do this long enough, somebody's going to beat all the odds and get all of them. But it would be a whole heck of a lot of testing, and we were never going to get to that number. So, we were pretty amazed at this guy, and we all shook his hand and let him know that even though he wasn't going after the $1 million, he came closer to it than anybody else. And it was a nice educational thing because we showed people that science can prove things that your intuition can't. It's a very valuable lesson. And heck, if you want to do a dowsing, if you run into me somewhere at VanFest or some other thing and you want to do a dowsing experiment, I have a perfect one. I'll be happy to demonstrate it for you. I will first convince you that you know how to douse, and then I will convince you that dowsing is not real. A place to visit. If you are ever in Amarillo, Texas, maybe you're doing Route 66 trip. I don't know why you're there. It's a fairly flat and dusty place, but it is on a major highway that takes you from east to west. If you're ever there, I would encourage you to visit the RV Museum and Storage. Yes, that's the name of the place. It's called the RV Museum and Storage. It's at 14,501 Interstate 27 in Amarillo, Texas. And, well, you know, sometimes things are named completely appropriately. Because the RV Museum and Storage, it's an RV museum, and they have storage. It's basically a storage place for RVs, but some of the RVs never leave. And that's the museum part. But the guy has some really cool old RVs. Some of the first Airstreams, some teardrops, a lot of the equipment that went in them. And the reason I encourage van life folks to go to RV museums is you get ideas for what to do in your own builds. All these vehicles have solved the same problems you want to solve. And it's interesting to see how things have changed. One of the things I love seeing in these museums is how water is handled. Today, we typically have a 12-volt on-demand pressure pump. Back then, they often used gravity. They would put the water tanks on the ceiling. Now, if you remember back earlier in this podcast, I said, watch out for weight. Well, that's why they don't do that anymore. Winnebago did it differently. They put the water tank on the bottom where it should be, but instead of having a pump, they pressurized the tank. So every time you got gas, you'd have the service people, and it was probably full serve back then, fill up your water tank with air, and that air would push on the water and make it run through the system. And you'll see these in all these rigs. Anyway, that's just one example. They have a whole bunch of rigs. They're open from 10 to 3 Thursday through Saturday, so it's fairly limited. And from everything I can see, it's free. There's a guest book, but you can wander around and see stuff. So, heck, Texas is a long state. It takes a long time to drive through Texas. You need a break. This would be a great place to visit. So I'll have a link in the show notes, but it's just rvmuseum.net. Next time I'm in Amarillo, I'm going here. Resource recommendation. When I was at the airport in Portland this weekend, I saw a van life cookbook in one of the shops at the airport, and I thought, that's kind of a weird place to have that, because the people here are flying. They're not traveling in vans. But, you know, van life still has some appeal to folks who don't do van life, and I know a lot of my listeners don't do van life and aren't interested in van life, and that's great. But aspects of it bleed over, and cooking is one of those. So I thought, you know, what's just a good general resource for van life cooking? I mean, we have some special restrictions. You know, we don't have a lot of space, we don't have good ways to clean, and we may not have all the ingredients. So I basically found the website for Van Life Eats, and it is called vanlifeeats.com. Yes, it's true. Now, this is a commercial site. And they have very, very fancy recipes on here. But if you're looking to make something special in your van, all of these recipes have been made in vans on this website. So one, I'm just going down some they have listed here. Cheesy arepas, the ultimate gluten-free snack. Arepas are a traditional dish that originates in the regions of Venezuela and Colombia. They look like little meat cakes. Omnia mashed potato cake, which you would use with your Omnia oven. We've talked about those in the past, but they're like fancy bundt pans that are very good for baking with. Stuffed Cobb Calabrese style, which is, looks like a quiche, actually. Pasta fagioli, Moroccan pancakes, Michel's dinner tamale pie. I mean, very fancy stuff, and also very varied stuff. Vegan sweet corn fritters, French onion and apple grilled cheese. So there's a good amount of vegan stuff here, but there's also a lot of stuff that isn't vegan. Chicken chipotle crunch, for example. Vegan jackfruit burgers. If you are brave enough to have jackfruit in your van, which is a relative of durian, well, more power to you. This would be a way to cook it. Anyway, if you're looking for some interesting recipes, you want to make a fancy meal for folks when you're in your van, I recommend you check out vanlifeeats.com. Looks like they're UK-based, but that shouldn't matter a whole lot because, you know, ultimately, food is food. Well, folks, thank you very much for listening to episode 225. And thanks to those of you who met up with me in Oregon. It was very nice to see you, and I know I didn't get to see everyone, and I apologize, but there's that time thing again. Music, as always, is by Simon Wagg. And until next time, remember the words of Oscar Wilde, who said, "Experience is simply the name we give our mistakes."